The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, An Evening with Michael Palin, was recorded at King's Place, London in November 2015. Michael Palin is in conversation with Guardian journalist John Crace.
Oh, that's awfully bright.
Far too comfortable. Far too comfortable.
And awfully bright, but never mind.
And very bright, yes, unlike me.
I mean, I'm sure you're all as thrilled to be here as I am. I am genuinely sort of, this is a man I am in awe of. He is a man who has sort of done everything that most of us would like to have done. A comedian, writer, screenwriter, actor, travel writer, or just about everything. And astonishingly, most astonishingly of all, a man about whom no one has a bad word to say. For a 50-year career in the media, that is probably the greatest achievement of all.
Depends which newspaper you read.
We're here to start off, Ben, talking about diaries. You've been keeping a diary since really the start of the sort of Pythons. I mean, was that coincidental? Or?
It was absolutely coincidental. I mean, I started in 1969, April. Now, I left university in 1965, started work on the Frost Reports as a writer with Terry Jones in 1966, and we just worked solidly for the next 4 or 5 years. Just everything, any show that came along that wanted writers, we were available. Whether it was Ken Dodd or, you know, Marty Feldman, that was what we had to do then. You didn't get paid very much. You got paid by the joke. And there wasn't much time for doing anything like diarising or anything like that. I mean, diary writings, right? And then there was a little break, and it was just after our son Tom, our oldest son, was born. At the beginning of 1969, I had this little breather, and I smoked quite a lot at that time, and I gave up smoking because of Tom, because the little boy wanted to put his arms around me and I had to put a cigarette out, you know, and sort of stub it out. Then he'd eat the butt.
Yeah.
The burns eventually. Yeah, they said you can't, you know, the news of the world will get you. But he, that was why I gave up smoking, and that was a great surge of willpower. And we'd also had a little break in the workshop. Terry and I had done a series called Complete and Utter History of Britain, and we didn't know what we were going to do next. And it wasn't a terribly successful series, though it was extremely funny. But John Cleese... yeah, exactly. Sometimes success and brilliance just don't match. But anyway, John Cleese rang up out of the blue and said, look, I've just seen your series, Complete and Utter History of Britain. And I said, oh, that's good, yeah. I was quite flattered. And he said, you won't be doing any more of those, will you? snide old bastard that he is. But, So there was a little break, and John said, why don't... I quite liked some of the stuff you were doing, you and Terry, and I liked Do Not Adjust Your Set, which you wrote with Eric Idle, and I'd been writing stuff with Graham Chapman, and we knew that because they were brilliant sketch writers. Why don't we all get together and try and do something different and new? And so, you know, I think the diary, which I'd started because I had this great willpower after giving up smoking... I was only about 2.5 weeks old when I noted down that the first meeting of what became Python later on took place.
And are you still keeping a diary?
Yep, I do. I mean, it's become now a habit with me. I just can't imagine not not writing something down to record the day before. And it's not absolutely every day. I mean, if there's been a day when I've done nothing at all, I mean, apart from breathe, then I don't really put had breath, had other breath.
No.
Another breath followed. So I give myself a break sometimes. But I do try and I feel now I have to record a day. It's as much a part of the habit of my life as cleaning my teeth, you know, in the mornings. And I just have to write it down.
And have you ever thought that there's anything off limits from the diary?
No, nothing at all. Because a diary is, I mean, it's essentially a personal thing. That's what makes a diary, I think, so valuable. It's just you writing your thoughts, not for anybody else. I mean, forget the fact that I had mine published, but I mean, when I...
Well, I was going to ask that because, no, I mean, is there a sort of act of censorship? I mean, once you've got three volumes, it won't have escaped people's notice that we've only got up to 1998 so far, and so there are another 17 years and counting.
Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is that when I wrote these, the diaries of which these books are published extracts, I didn't think of publishing them at all. I mean, it didn't enter my mind that I should publish them until about 2006, when two things happened. I was asked to write my autobiography, and I thought, oh, God, well, where do I... If I wrote an autobiography, the source material would be the diaries. So, you know, I thought, well, why not just publish the diaries? And also, a friend of mine who's quite astute on these matters said, I think, you know, people would like to read about what you felt about things while you're still alive. It's a very good point, because then you can sort of at least enjoy them together. And I mean, there's nothing much in my diaries that is so ghastly and awful that I would lose friends forever and ever. And yet there's a lot of things that over time become quite interesting bits of history, like, you know, the IRA bombings in London or something like that, which seemed like eons ago, but there they are in the diary. And you know, one can talk about these things with the people who are reading your diaries. But anyway, I jump ahead. I mean, the point is that I wrote these without any idea of publishing, and that's what is important about a diary. It's your personal thoughts, which you then write down that day and put them in a drawer, and that's it. It's not like doing a blog where you know you've got an audience out there and you're going to sort of spill it all straight away.
I mean, but I was reading quite early on, it's so you, in a way. There is a sort of bit about Graham Chapman, and it's clear that, you know, he's been sort of moonlighting somewhere else, and he hasn't been kind of pulling his weight on the Python writing. And you say, but I mustn't go on about that, because that these aren't those kind of diaries.
Oh, yeah. Well, did I say that?
Yeah.
Really? In these?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah, no, I have,
well,
yeah.
There we are.
One of us has read them, Michael.
Oh, I wrote them. I don't have to read them. I do step out as a diarist to make little jokes about keeping diaries, and I know that at certain points I put, you know, that's enough, Ed, in brackets when I'm banging on about something. But that was a little joke to myself, really, rather than to posterity.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
So, so your family would recognise you from these diaries?
Well, I suppose that I hope so. No, the thing is that what you see here is actually an edit of there's only about 20% of what I actually wrote ends up in these diaries. So they are quite selective. And family business, including family holidays and all that, were kind of cut very early on to try and make the reduction work.
Yeah.
And this had a very good advisor called Ian Truin, who died recently, and very, very sad loss, because he was a very helpful editor. He edited the Alan Clark diaries, which are some of the most classic modern diaries. So he knew about diaries. And he said, look, get rid of family holidays and every meal you had and all that. I don't know why he said that, because I couldn't do that, because almost everything that happened to me in my life happened over a meal or after a meal. And we did eat an awful lot. Because I'm freelance, we met in restaurants. That's where we did a lot of business.
No, I remember that there is a lot of eating in restaurants.
Yeah, I know. Well, there was a hell of a lot more, I tell you. Whole menus elaborately written out. But that's, again, a celebration. The diaries are sort of on a good day, you celebrate what you've done. And the fact I put in the fact that I had a particular bottle of wine or particularly fine risotto or particularly good prawns actually was kind of... was important to that day. That was a good part of the day, and I think that's what, you know, the English are not very good at acknowledging food as being some part of everyday life, whereas on the continent you do, you know.
Yeah, and we go back at the sort of beginning with sort of the pythons, which sort of did feel like a change in sort of comedy. It was the accumulation of stuff that was happening with the Frost Report. And but did you have any sense at the time that this was a sort of huge thing going on, and then the way that sort of comedy was being, you were rewriting the rules virtually?
I think we were aware that we were writing a different kind of comedy. We were presenting it in a different form from the way comedy had been presented, with just little short snatches of material, as opposed to sketches which had a beginning and a middle and an end, which is the way everyone had done it before. But I mean, Spike Milligan had been doing things like this before. We had Terry Gilliam's animation, which was an absolute breakthrough. That was something quite new. And we wanted to do little things that would irritate the BBC or any broadcasting company that put us on. Like, you know, we'd turn the set off halfway through. You know, that dot that went used to go. And the BBC said, you can't do that again, because people will think we've broken down and we get lots of calls and all that. So we had to restate. But little things like that sort of were mischievous things that we did. They hadn't really been done before. But, I mean, the feeling was, will we get away with it? Not, this is groundbreaking.
Yeah.
This is going to change everything. It was, how much can we get away with?
And were the stuff that you couldn't get away with?
Well, the BBC put us out very late at night.
Yeah, it was about 10 past 11 or something.
Yeah, 10 past 11, because they didn't want children to see it, or indeed anybody.
Anyone.
anyone who wasn't suffering from an insomnia to see it. And, you know, they used to take it off when something overran, like Horse of the Year Show.
Yeah.
Python always got taken off. There were no Monty Python tonight because Horse of the Year Show has gone on for half an hour. So for the first two series, really, we got away with it. We were allowed to develop the humour. BBC gave us no sort of guidelines. They didn't. I don't think they even watched up in the comedy department. They had Morecambe and Wise. They had Dad's Army.
Yeah.
Those were the things they were really, really concerned about. And it was very, very good for Python because it allowed us to sort of hone our humour. And it was only when the third series came about that they began to be aware that they had something which people were actually watching and quite liking.
Well, so that's a disaster for them.
Exactly. We've got to find out what's gone wrong here. But 10 past 11 at night. And they watched it, and of course they didn't like what they saw some of the time. And we had a wonderful dust-up over... It was the first time we had any censorship at all. And we had some censorship in the third series. It was truly wacky. It was really over the word masturbating. And there was a sketch called the Summarise Proust competition, where contestants have to summarise Proust's masterwork and other chefs to Tom Pair do in 15 seconds.
Yeah.
A silly sort of spoof of a Yorkshire talent show. But each contestant was asked his hobbies. And one man's hobbies were strangling animals, golf, and masturbating. And there was a great studio laugh. And the next morning, the BBC, sort of ashen-faced, came to us and said, what did you do? You've said the M-word. On you can't do that on television. Well, no children watching anything like that. No, just you can't do it. You cannot say that word. You're going to have to cut it from the tape, which goes out the next week. Mm. And we said, well, can we discuss this? And they said, well, I'm nothing to discuss. But we eventually engineered a meeting with the head of comedy, and all the pythons went up to the sixth floor where his office was, and sat round in a circle to discuss whether we could use them masturbating. And Terry Jones got very sort of Welsh and passionate about it and said, oh, come on, you know, I masturbate, you masturbate, we all masturbate. And the head of comedy was clearly pulled on his cigarette.
Yeah.
What have we got here? But despite Terry's reasoned arguments, we had to cut.
Yeah.
So when it went out, you got this extraordinary cut. The word masturbating was cut out. So what are your hobbies? Strangling animals, golf, pause, huge laugh. you know, on golf. I mean, golf has never got such a big laugh. And what I really like about the whole thing is that strangling animals was fine. They never picked us up on that. BBC says okay to strangling animals.
Yeah.
But anyway, all that, you'd never be allowed to do anything like that nowadays. Just, yeah. But there we go. Yeah.
And it's also quite clear from the reading the diaries that, I mean, a lot of it seemed to be sort of quite last minute, and you seem remarkably casual about, you've got sort of, just 11 weeks to go to do 11 shows virtually, and, I mean,
well, you know,
did you not, was there not a sense of panic?
Well, I suppose that there was some sense of urgency. We were all quite professional. I mean, I think people think that Python just put together by a lot of people who are stoned all the time. I mean, we're absolutely, absolutely sort of sober throughout. All of us had this initial training in university review. And that had been quite a good apprenticeship because you had to write and perform your own material for an audience there in the university. And that was, I mean, in Cambridge, where John and Graham were, it was very organised in the footlights. Oxford, it was less sort of structured. But that's basically what you had to do. And you only got one go at it. So you had to know your material, you had to be able to perform it well, you had to do it crisply. So we all actually were quite efficient. And when we were told we had to do the shows, we knew we would get them and we would rehearse them and we'd do them properly in the end. It wasn't really panic, it was just there was a lot to do in a very, very short time. But that was a kind of quite an exciting part of it. And of course, we did filming in advance, so you'd film some of the stuff in advance. But it was, I mean, the difficult thing was that sometimes there were sketches that didn't work that well, there wasn't much time to rewrite them, you know. So there were definite occasions when substandard material got in. But
but not your stuff.
Yeah, well, mostly our stuff, actually. Yeah. Terry Jones and myself were the workhorses. We produced tons and tons of stuff. And John and Graham would just produce the occasional classic sketch, like Dead Parrot or something like that. in the end, I think we wrote more of it than they did. But
who's counting?
I am. Yeah. We all got paid the same, which is very little.
And, I mean, it's also quite one thing that I'd sort of forgotten. I mean, you know, I was sort of an age where I kind of grew up with this stuff. I was sort of 13 when the first one came out, and it was like a light bulb going on, sort of. There was, and it was, but it did become quite commodified quite quickly. You were doing sort of records and books and all sorts of things that... and now, you know, you kind of feel that everyone is trying to do. But I'd forgotten that sort of amidst it was, there was quite a professional operation, a sort of marketing operation going on at the same time.
Well, yeah, it wasn't, I mean, I may have seen that professional, but certainly the intention was to capitalise as much as we could on Python's success as a television show, because that was our livelihood. We had wives and families and mortgages to support and all that. What we did do, though, was we took the decision that every single add-on that we did, whether it was a book or an album, had to be a separate material. We did one album, which the BBC made, which is... Python's biggest hits, and we did all that. The rest, we wrote new material for the albums. We wrote new materials for the book and all that. So that we did feel very much that you had to give people something, that our audience were a very loyal audience. It might be kind of small audience, but they were loyal, and we'd set quite a high standard, we felt. And we've got to maintain that in anything else that we produce. I mean, it's not the same now. We just don't turn out any old rubbish. but that was definitely the feeling at the time, and that meant it was quite difficult because you had to accumulate the material. There were some people who you know wanted to produce our records and all that. There were some encouraging people. We had to basically produce the stuff, and so we were working very, very hard. At the same time, seeing Python begin to disintegrate after the third series, you know, and John was wanting to go off somewhere else. And there we are, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and if we were reading your diary from last year, and the sort of Python reunion. Mm. What would we find there in terms of, I mean, did you actually really enjoy it? I mean, clearly it sold out within seconds and was a huge financial success. Mm. But there did appear to be, I mean, some members of the Python seemed to be keener on it than others.
Yeah, well, I think that you'd have to look over all the whole project and how it came about. And the fact, in these diaries, funnily enough, the very end of the diary, December 1998, Pythons are discussing whether or not to do a live show at Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And I was one who said no, and others, you know, there was a difference of opinion. Anyway, we didn't do it. And it sort of has always come up over the years. Should we do a live show? Should we not do a live show? And it never really worked. We were never in the right place at the right time. But this live show, the O2 show, came about because we had had a court case, part of which had gone against us. So we had to pay, didn't have to pay an awful lot to the victim, if it were, or whoever it was, the guy who was a Python producer of Holy Grail. But we had to pay an awful lot for lawyers. And also John was banging on about his alimony tour, you know, having to pay for his wife.
Yes, well, I think Terry was saying much the same thing, wasn't he?
Well, Terry Jones was saying it was about a mortgage. His mortgage. So there we are.
So did you feel it was a charitable act
on the part of...
of those of you who had stayed married and didn't exactly. have a mortgage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I knew it was worth staying married, and then I realised why. So then we had a change of manager because things had not been going terribly well and not very well organised. And a guy called Jim Beach, and Jim manages Queen, and he was an old friend from Cambridge of Eric and John. And I know Jim quite well. And he just said, look, if you want to make some money, clear all your debts, do a couple of nights at the O2. What? You know, we never dreamt of thinking that ourselves. He said, no, you'll be fine. Then do a couple of nights, and maybe you do a third night if you sell the tickets. So it was his, you know, he shook us into doing this, and we said, oh, God. Then the tickets went on sale, and boom, you know, they were sold 5 nights straight away, and they wanted another 5. And the diaries, if you read my diaries, it would all be, hang on, this is all going too fast. Mm. We have sold these tickets. There's going to be an amazing reaction, which has surprised us all. Now we've got to deliver, and will we be able to deliver? Will we actually be able to remember the lines, get on stage without having heart attacks? Should we have medical attention while we're doing the sketches and all that sort of thing? I mean, really, that's what is in my diary, is a lot of doubts about the whole project. Mm. And Eric was wanting to put in a lot of singing and dancing, and I was being a bit, well, you know, maybe it should just be the sketches, and we don't want dancers and all that. Anyway, in the end, you would see in the diaries this massive relief that the first night you realised, for various reasons, thank God, we got it right.
Yeah.
The dancers were great, the music was great, people were kind of quite happy to... Well, they're very happy to see us on stage at all, but they were kind of energised. Everybody, they're all in their 70s. I mean, they are all. We are all in their 70s. Although I'm less in the 70s than some.
Of course.
Thank you. Thank you, John. But everybody enjoyed it, and there was a kind of physical energy about the things that we did. It wasn't, oh, God, how are we going to get through this? It was a great experience, and the main thing is, you know, I just remember my family all who've never really bothered with Python, my children and all that, not being quite their thing. They came along and they were amazed. They were amazed at the sort of the way it was and the extraordinary sort of reaction from the audience and all that sort of thing.
Well, so they took you seriously for the first time.
Yeah, well, they did. yes, exactly. Seeing me dressed in drag playing a judge, they took it seriously. Suddenly, Dad is really, he's got a proper job. So that's, you ask about the diaries. So there would be a lot of doubts. And it's been interesting to sort of, I'd like to go over and read that again, because that's the great thing about the diary. You'd write things on an evening long before the shows were successful, and it would just, there's no doubt about it, you would say, I'm very worried about this, and we've got to go and do another press conference tomorrow, and we've got to grin at the cameras, and it's just, you know, we've got to do this, that, and the other, which we don't really like doing. And... Of course, now with hindsight, you see the shows worked and it was all great. But if you just take those particular days, you realise that there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of a doubt about how it was all going to work and whether all the hype that we were having to engineer ourselves. You know, we had to turn out and have endless photo calls and talk to the press all the time and make up stories for the press.
Did it really surprise you? I mean, the attention. Because so much of the material had become sort of part of our national culture. The gags survive, even, you know, when Jeremy Corbyn was in the leadership election, you know, the gag was, he's not the Messiah, he's just a naughty boy. And, you know, that was sort of being sort of revived and reiterated, but it's sort of... The gags have become part of the sort of national consciousness, really.
Well, I kind of know that, but then filling, you know, 15,000 seats in an arena for 10 nights, I would never, ever, ever have expected that. And, of course, what I forget is that a lot of the people who came along were from abroad. I mean, a hell of a lot of people from Spain and Germany and America, Australia all came along. So it was like Python, this... One forgets that Python is more popular in America than it is here.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 They love it there. You can go over and... I think that international kind of appeal pushed it up and made it all seem... But why things become, sort of things like Spanish Inquisition and all that become things that people know so well... I just don't know, as opposed to anything else. But they do, and then once they're there, they're kind of going to always be there, I think, for some people somewhere. I think the key thing about Python was it was never popular with everybody. And the people who really picked up on it were very loyal to it because they were told by a lot of other people it wasn't funny. And you have to say, no, it is funny. So it's your little protest against the world and all that sort of thing. I remember always used to get cab drivers who say, you know, not Monty Python, you're not Monty Python. And I would say, yeah, my wife hates it. And it was always like this. Always with them, you know, cab drivers' wives always hated it. without a single exception.
And were you sort of, sort of going back to, you know, the 1970s, were you sad or relieved when it came to an end?
Well, I mean, it never really came to an end. That's the thing. That's what the diaries show. We just kept... We had to keep meeting for business reasons and all that sort of thing. I was very sad when the television series came to an end because I thought the third series, there was still more we could do. John had decided he didn't want to do any more. I think a lot of us felt we had another few shows in us. In fact, we did do six shows without John. Which were quite good. I mean, he was a writer, but he wasn't in it. Yeah, they weren't nearly as good as if he'd been in it. But I'm quite sad that happened. With the films, it was an absolutely natural process. We were lucky to get Holy Grail off the ground. Brian came along purely because the American market had suddenly discovered Python, so we were bankable. And Meaning of Life was just much more difficult to write, took much longer to write. We didn't have the kind of narrative that you had with the story of the Grail or Brian and all that. So actually, by the time we'd done Meaning of Life, I think we all felt we've come to the end. You know, we're not producing any, you know, wonderfully funny new ideas. We're not working quite as well together. So I think that at that time I felt quite happy that it was over. But it's never over because everyone's still around, all coming up with ideas and whatever.
But you have continually sort of reinvented yourself sort of throughout your career. You went on to sort of screenplays, kind of sort of film actor. Did you ever have a plan or has everything been on the hoof?
Everything's been sort of on the hoof, really. I've never had a plan. I don't know where the plan would begin. I mean, you know, it's kind of... most of the things I've done in my life have been because I've met someone at a certain time who has said, Michael, you know, you're funny or you can write this. Have a go at this. I'm not very good at starting things myself.
Yeah.
And I look back on almost everything from writing with Terry Jones. Well, I wrote with Terry Jones at university. Yeah. And Terry was a year ahead of me. And we did write together for the Frost Report and all that. But when it came to Python, you know, I mean, that was John's phone call, I suppose, that pushed us into it. And when it, in fact, when I started doing comedy at university, I would never have been on stage writing and performing comedy had it not been for a guy I met who was much more pushy than I was. And he was from London, and he said, come on, you know, instead of just telling each other funny stories and enjoying Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers, let's do something ourselves. Let's get a cabaret together. And I was from Sheffield, and he was from sort of, you know, Kensington. I didn't really know what cabaret was at that time. I thought it was something French ladies did, kicking their legs up in the garden. But he said, no, no, cabarets, everyone has them now, balls, parties, all that sort of thing. I can get us a fee for just being funny together. Let's write an act. I would never have dreamt of doing that. And he did it. This was at Oxford, and the first time I ever performed on stage was at the Oxford University Psychological Society Christmas party, which was the most wonderful
that
event.
That sounds like a barrel of laughs.
It went down, it was absolute silence at the end of it. And then they said, that was wonderful.
I guess that they needed wonderful. To think about it.
They said, well, exactly. They said, the classic thing, they said, so much to think about. Yeah. Is this the way comedy works? You're not supposed to think. But, you know, that was the start of, and without Robert, this guy Robert Hewson, I don't think I perhaps would have even done that. So I've been pushed. Mm. There are certain things like, you know, the film about my great-grandfather, American Friends, which was my idea, and the missionary and things like that. But there's really been no great plan. It's just whatever's around, and it's the people you're with, what ideas they have. It's meeting somebody who says, oh, you know, why don't you do an arts program? You know, I've done a series of 5 or 6 arts shows. Purely because somebody else said, you've got a painting, we're making a program about the woman who painted this, would you like to be the presenter? Oh, yeah, all right. You know? So I just said, yeah, all right, suppose that could be the story of my life. Yeah, all right, thanks. I'm still looking for a proper job. I mean, I really am. I do a talk, and I used to do a talk, it was called the schools and things like that, and I call it 40 Years Without a Proper Job. It's now about 45 years without a proper job, so it's going up. But that's the thing. I was brought up by in an environment where people had proper jobs. My father had a proper job. He was a manager in a steelworks and all that sort of thing. And that's what you had to do, and that's what you had to get. And this came with being an adult, came with being grown up. You will find a time when hair grows on various parts of your body and your balls drop, and then suddenly you become an adult and you will get a job as a manager or something like that. And, I mean, some of the things happened, but the manager thing, I never really got to that. So I've been very, very lucky. I've just been sort of making it up as I go along. But I do have a certain sense of, I think, of quality control. I like to think I have that.
No, I was going to ask, I mean, are there some sort of projects that you would have sort of rather that you hadn't done and that sort of are now documented in your diaries and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and sort of can't be airbrushed out of history in the way that you might like.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing. For instance, I always resisted doing commercials only because I felt, well, I used to go and audition for commercials.
I mean, there's a very good story about a Maxwell House.
That's right. Yeah. Very early on in my career, and everybody was wanting to do voiceovers and that sort of thing. So I'm not being sort of. I'm sort of high-minded about it. And I went along, for this Maxwell House ad. And I was, you know, there was a lot of people behind the screen, and I was put into the studio. Mm-hmm. And I had to do this thing, which was the wonderful sound of Maxwell House. And I just, this is ridiculous. You're selling coffee? The sound of coffee? Are we not in a mad world? Yeah. So I did, the wonderful sound of Maxwell House. And they came out and said, you may think this is funny, but there are people out there in the library. Yeah, and I realised then that there were 12 people in that control booth who depended on the sound of Maxwell House ad for a living. Yeah. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do this if I don't have to do it. Yeah. And I haven't done it for a long time. So that's one area. But I've done things which haven't worked as well as I thought they ought to work. And that's in the diary. In this diary here, there's I helped a friend get the Meridian... the franchise for Meridian Television, which is Southern Television, in 19, 92 when the franchises were being a lot reallocated. And there was a lot of, you know, good, you know, belief in making better television and all that sort of thing. And I was on board for this bid. We got the bid, and then I had to do something in the region for the bid. And that's usually the wrong way around. You've got to do something because it's funny, you've got a funny idea. But this was because you had to do something in the Southern Meridian region. And Roger Mills, who's director of a lot of the travel shows I've done, and a wonderful, wonderful guy, had this idea that I should go and do a thing called Palin's Column. I'd go to the Isle of Wight, and I would spend a week there getting stories, and at the end I would write a column for the local paper. So you'd see me writing the column, the editor would criticise it and send me out, and I'd go and do a bit. And it just didn't quite work. It didn't work, yeah. Rather, because the editor himself was... He's not here tonight. But he's not a live wire. And they would say, now, so is Michael... What do you think of Michael's column? He'd say, oh, I think that's very good. But, I mean, there's things you want to change? Well, Michael, can go and do up. No, I think it's all right for us.
So it's a short programme.
So it was a bit short programme. And there were four of these, and I just had to go and do idiotic things around the Isle of Wight. And it was quite fun in a way, but it didn't kind of... It didn't hit its mark. And so I felt that was a bit of a waste of time. Otherwise, I mean, everything's part of experience. I'm quite happy with most of the things I've done.
No, because, I mean, you tell a very good story against yourself. I think it's the end. When you were given a part in You've Got Mail.
Oh, yes.
and you get a sort of call from Nora for saying, we love you. You're so good that we're not going to use you. And, I mean... Does that happen? I mean, is that something that happens to regularly in acting and stuff like that?
Do you find that
the film you're in suddenly doesn't have your name in the credits?
Well, it depends who you are. I mean, if you're Benedict Cumberbatch, I think they probably wouldn't ring up and say, sorry, Benedict, not good enough. given the part to...
We're going to do Hamlet without you.
Given the part to John Cleese. But... it does happen, and it's happened to me occasionally. It happened over... I recorded Roald Dahl's... some Roald Dahl's books. Mm. And there was some mix-up there, and they never... The family evidently didn't like the way I'd done it, or there was something there. They were never released. And that was a rather an odd thing. I didn't like that, because there was no communication. No one told me. I'm very happy to be criticised. It's very nice. Let's all... sit round together and decide how we can do it better or worse. But the thing about You've Got Mail was great fun, because it was the best job I ever had. I was flown to America by Concorde, a week's filming with Meg Ryan, night filming in the streets of New York. I felt like an absolute top film star. I knew the part wasn't great, and I wasn't doing it particularly well, but, you know... what the hell, you know? I was with Meg and, you know, her hubby. Who's her hubby at the time? I can't remember. It was... One of these big stars.
I feel that you should know better than me.
Well, she kept saying, oh, he's on the line. Say hello.
Yeah.
Said, oh, hello. And he's, Mom, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So it was a really good thing to do. But as I say, yes, it was rather a pity in the end that Nora Ephron rang up. And it was rather unfortunate because she rang up. I was going to do a series about Hemingway. Came the Hemingway Adventure, and there was a new director I'd not worked with before, and he came round to the house, and we were going to discuss. Oh God, this is, I kept saying, "I'm so glad to be working with you. It's great. We've got you to do this." And the phone rings, and it's Nora Ephron, bless her, lovely, saying exactly what you said. Michael, it's absolutely brilliant. It's terrific. You did it so well, but we can't fit it in the film. So it's not going to be there. Any of it? No, another bit. Okay, thank you. She said, hey, was that Nora? Nora Ephron? Oh, wow, God, what did you say? Sorry,
it was a
It was a bad moment, bad moment. But I recovered from it, and we made a series together.
Yeah. And how did you get, from there to travelling almost everywhere around the world? How did that sort of come about? How did it go down when you sort of announce to your family, I'm actually going to be away for 3 months? How did that go down well?
Well, I mean, I had to explain a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't going with Meg Ryan for 3 months around the globe. And it was going to be tough and horrible. And no, I think the... I mean, I got a call out of the blue from the BBC, blah, blah, blah. We've got this idea around the world in 80 days. Nothing, it's nothing like it's been done before. There's going to be camera following the presenter all the way around, you know. There'll never be a moment when you're not on camera, all that. You're the one who's the only one who can do it. And they gave me a lot of stuff about being adventurous and sort of charismatic and all this crap. And anyway, I said, yes, I fell for all that. And it was only when I was halfway around the world that the director had had a few beers and admitted I was the fifth person they'd asked to do. So,
did you find out who the other four were?
Yeah. I mean, there was... Alan Wicker was the first one. But it wouldn't have worked with Alan.
Because he's already had his own world.
He had his world, exactly. Yeah. And it was a very different kind of world where you wore a suit and you had people, you know, so you had lots of aftershave and all that. I mean, he wouldn't have lasted on the Dow.
Yeah.
And the BBC, I don't think they were serious with Alan because apparently when they pitched the idea to him, they took him to the Pizza Hut in Shepherd's Bush. And Alan Wicker didn't do Pizza Hut, absolutely not. He stayed in the penthouse in the Dorchester. You don't go to Shepherd's Bush and eat the Pizza Hut. So I don't think they were serious about him.
Yeah.
Miles Kington was the second one. Yeah. He was a very good guy. I mean, again, someone I knew at Oxford, a contemporary of mine, died tragically young, and a really, really wonderful guy. And he would have been very funny doing it. He didn't want to. Noel Edmonds then turned it down. We're getting now
well,
to
God,
embarrassing
moments.
Well,
God, you really
moments.
Have saved
we are.
Us.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. One of the cleaners at the BBC turned it down. Who's the... Clive James was the other one. But I didn't mind. I was very grateful to do it. What was your question? I can't remember.
Well, I mean, also what comes through from the diaries very clearly of the travel is actually, I mean, probably something that didn't necessarily come across on the screen is that there is you kind of feeling a genuine sense of jeopardy in the diaries about are you actually going to make it, you know, around the world? I mean, when the TV programme sort of came on, there was a sort of natural assumption that you would do it.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of times when it seems like it was genuinely hairy.
Yeah.
What were your kind of worst moments in terms of sort of time breaks and sort of dashes here, there and everywhere?
Well, the first, in the diary, the worst moments actually, it's not to do with time, it's just the very beginning of the journey. When I suddenly realised, I woke up and we're going down the Adriatic, leaving Venice on this Greek ship to go down through the Mediterranean. And I suddenly think, what am I doing here? You know, I've got 6 hours of television to fill. Now, I'm going to be the one who's going to have to do all this. Am I, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? Am I a presenter in the sense like Alan Wicker, who would sum up and have a little sort of chat about the world and what's happening? Not my scene. Am I supposed to be an actor playing a Phileas Fogg character? So there's a great crisis of confidence at the very beginning. That was the worst time of all. And I honestly did think, hey, I took this on because it was such a wonderful idea. You're going around the world, the BBC are paying. And then it was just total sense of inadequacy. But then it was okay. And I eventually, it was on the Dow sequence, where we were 7 days and seven nights with this crew of fishermen from North India and, you know, just slept on deck and all that. And there was no time to think about your motivation. I was just me being me. So once I got over that, at least I felt I know how to play this. The real difficulties were when we got ahead of ourselves on the... Well, all right, the Saudi Peninsula was very difficult. We fell behind there. Then there was a boat in India which kind of broke down. When we got across the Pacific and caught up a lot of time and felt very, very comfortable. Hey, we're going to do this in no time at all. So we stopped overnight in Aspen and did a whole sequence, a rather nice sequence of dog sledding and balloons. And that used our sort of free day. And from that point on, it was very tricky indeed. and we got to Chicago and we were really racing. We had to go by train. Transfer to another train, and we got to Chicago and we're at the station rushing to catch the train to New York, and I heard a voice saying, Mr. Michael Palin on the train from Los Angeles, please cut out the information. And God, oh, God, what's happened? You know, everything's fallen apart. So I rushed around. We had 5 minutes to catch the train. I've got to information. And they said, we have a call for you. And that's the guy says, hello, Mike. You remember when you were last in Chicago? We did those commercials together. Love to see you if you're in town. Why don't we do a meal together? I said, fuck, I've got 2 minutes to get the train. Just got the train. And then we got on the boat and we were very, very tight for time then. We had to get the fastest possible boat across the Atlantic. And fortunately, we got a Danish ship, Maersk ship, very, very fast. And it was the last night we were going into, and they suddenly said, we're not in, you know, this is not Southampton, this is Le Havre. I mean, no one told us you were stopping in Le Havre. Oh, yes, yes, we're stopping here. It won't be long, you know. No. We just unload a bit of cargo and then we'll go to Felixstowe. Felixstowe? I thought we were going to Southampton. No, we go to Felixstowe. Oh, God, it's a nightmare. But we got there, and that's what we got to Felixstowe on the very last day. And it was only a few hours in it. So that was the panic. Those were the panic buttons there.
So it was sort of true to the book, really.
It was actually in the end, without the princesses and all that sort of stuff,
yeah.
Burning themselves. I think we didn't get around to that.
And your sort of future, I mean, there doesn't seem to be anywhere. I mean, are there any places you've regretted going to? Have you sort of any sort of adventures that, in hindsight, you wouldn't have done?
Well, I wouldn't have gone and had leech treatment in Estonia by this Russian lady. Have you ever had leech treatment?
No, oddly,
have you?
No,
oddly not.
No.
They probably don't do it on the National Health, but in Estonia they do. And I just, that was just a really weird, weird thing.
And when you
lay there, and these little tiny leeches, they're quite small to start with, and they gradually just grow on your blood. And there was a big Russian lady who was sort of looking at me with big smiles. Yes, they're doing well, they're doing well. I said, my blood's going, they're huge, they're being inflated. And at the end, she came in with a large glass of vodka, and I thought, well, at least she's got that right.
Yeah.
And she said, no, not for you, for them. She picked them off and dropped them in the vodka and killed them. So I'm going to go back and see her again.
And did you actually feel better as a result of this?
No, I just felt short of blood. I didn't have perfectly good blood. There was nothing nasty to take out. But, I mean, a lot of bad things happened in Russia. We had some very difficult experiences there. But I would always go back there. Because it's just manic. I mean, it just things happen in Russia would never happen anywhere else, good and bad. I mean, where else would I have been allowed to sing with the Russian Pacific Fleet Choir allowed me to go and sing with them and do a silly sequence where I'm trying to learn a Russian song. And they played it absolutely perfectly. There must have been 40 of them. Ooh, 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 ooh. Oh, there they were. No, 40, 100 of them. And I was allowed to go and arrive late and then get the words wrong and all that sort of stuff. So they were great on that, but they also, I mean, the drink is kind of quite a killer. And we had to do sequences where there were vodka toasts and all that. I've never drunk so much vodka in my life in one place, in Novgorod, which is, Novgorod's the ancient capital of Russia, and it's also twinned with Watford.
Inevitably.
Which is good. I don't know who it's good for. So we were told by the people in Watford, would we take something from Watford to Novgorod in a little exchange? So there was kind of a glass jar which said love from Watford on it, so I had to give them that. But anyway, the night before this ceremony took place, I had to have all these drinks with this Russian film director. And the next morning, I had such a hangover. And I woke up in this rather tatty hotel room and I went to throw up in the sink, and I just had to. And I got the sink, and the sink just came away from the wall. And I was staggering around the room with the sink, seeing, where do I get a line, the hole in the sink, with the drain? Brilliant way of stopping me from vomiting. I was absolutely fine, absolutely fine. And the bowl was given to Novgorod, and Novgorod gave us the most beautiful, beautiful plate for Watford. Mm. Lovely piece of work, sort of glass plate. It was gorgeous, and it was broken by the couriers on from Heathrow Airport. we never got it to the office and all that. Never got it to Watford, but there we are.
We seem to have got slightly off topic of the diaries.
I know. Well, that's okay.
But I mean, a lot of the fun of the diaries are the sort of the transient things that sort of, I mean, the little bits and pieces that sort of, I mean, most of us
who don't keep diary. I mean, I've never dreamt of keeping a diary, but huge amounts have just sort of gone missing. But you've got some, and yeah. I would love you to read a few bits.
I just did sort of mark up three little bits, just because exactly that, they're the little moments that you would never normally think of, were of any consequence. But when you look back, they're rather sort of entertaining in their little way and quite surprising. And I've just got three little bits here. One of them is from 1996, and it's about Sid, our window cleaner. Thursday, October the 24th, 1996. Sid, who suffers from vertigo, comes to clean the windows. He tells Helen later he's also an alcoholic. Helen asks if he's undergoing any treatment. He says there's an alcoholism unit at the Royal Free Hospital, but he can't go there because it's on the 10th floor. This is really it, you know. And there's another one here. This is a little thing, which is purely, obviously, an anxiety dream, which I've written down here, because it was when, yeah, 1992, I was in my late 40s, and my sight, you know, your sight is beginning to go, and, of course, you don't believe it's you. It's just there's been a voltage cut throughout the kingdom.
And
you can read perfectly well, so long as you read out there. Well, no, clearly, I was going to have glasses, and this was a big worry for me, because, and this is April 27th, 1992, graphic dream that Helen was having another baby. Couldn't get the midwife, so it was just her and me. Helen lying on a bed with placenta and afterbirth, all in amongst the duvet, telling me quite cheerfully that the baby is in there somewhere. I find it, but I'm unable to tell its sex without my glasses on. Okay, one more little
that
one.
That was
here.
The you should have gone to Specsavers moment, really, isn't it? Right. No, you could do an advert for
could
that.
Do an ad for Specsavers. If there's anyone from Specsavers in the audience, forget what I said about not doing ads.
Yeah.
This is July the 28th, 1992, at St. Paul's Covent Garden for Joan Sanderson's memorial service. Glorious summer's day, bright sunshine, cloudless skies. At St. Paul's, the vicar is escorting a muttering, grubby man out of the church and trying to be nice to him at the same time. Yes, yes, you wait outside. Quite full, Alan Bennett next to Joe Tewson at the back. Tim West gives an address. Good, rousing, uncomplicated hymns. Fight the good fight, he would valiant be. The batting man remains outside, shouting wankers at us. So there you are, little things, little moments that must have actually happened.
Yeah, yeah, I mean it's all glorious stuff. And I mean, if you could go back and sort of, what for you are the real highlights? What are the bits that sort of, you know, if you could go back and do it again, you would definitely go and do it again?
What, in my life?
Yeah.
Well, I think I would do almost the entire Himalaya series again, because that was just absolutely fantastic and extraordinary. And I was just, it all happened so quickly, I wasn't able to really kind of take it all in. So I'd probably do that. And then I might go back to the Isle of Wight and do it better. or ring Meg Ryan and see if she wants to do a sort of sequel. No, I mean, I think things are done, and they're done, and that's it. I think best of all would be the early days of Python. It was a great time then, because we weren't well known. Nothing was expected of us. We weren't stars. We weren't expected to do publicity for this, that, and the other. We just got together on a hunch that we could make people laugh. We made each other laugh uproariously on some of those sessions. And that was before the shows had even gone out. And it was that first summer of Python. I remember sort of interviewing Spike once, Spike Milligan, and I said the Goon shows, you know, just so important to me. They were so liberating and anarchic and fresh and different and, bold. And I said, well, you know, what was it like, you know, doing the Goon shows? Was it fantastic? And he said it was like one good summer, which is a beautiful thing to say. I know what he meant, you know. We always have that slightly nostalgic thing, that the sun's always shining. So I'd go back to that first summer when we were writing Python, and no one had any expectations of it, but nearly all the sketches that people now quote again and again were probably written during that summer.
And what makes you laugh now? I mean, are this, do you still find the same things funny now that you found then? I mean, is the sort of absurd and the surreal and the bizarre?
I mean, anyone taking themselves terribly seriously makes me giggle a little bit. It's funny. I mean, I don't watch a lot of comedy. I mean, there's the stuff that I like. W1A, I think, is wonderful, and that kind of the writing, John Morton's writing there. And I used to like things like the fast shows, good old sketch shows, and all that. But generally, I kind of feel now I watch very gloomy things. I watch Scandinavian sort of you know cop dramas and all that, where terrible things happen. And there's not a lot of laughs in there.
And I find it's so dark you can't see what's happening.
No, that's right, yeah. But you can. and it's all in Danish or Swedish.
Yeah.
Clever that, though, isn't it? Because if they're in subtitles, you've got to
pay attention.
You've got to pay attention.
Yeah.
You know, you just go out the room to have a pee or something like that, and you've lost four vital lines.
So
I don't. I mean, a lot. Just things generally make me laugh. I don't know, whatever it is, pomposity of any kind or whatever. I can't think of any in particular. People who fall over. As I did the other day on the uncleared leaves left by Camden Council. I went right on my arse in front of some people who thought it was very funny.
Really?
Yeah. You know, Python, I'm afraid you're branded.
Yeah.
If you fall over on the leaves, that's extremely funny. Yeah. He must have been doing it for a sketch. Yeah. Is there a camera there? Yeah. No, I've broken my back.
And are there any plans for the next volume of diaries?
No, I've sort of deliberately stopped. Well, the publisher commissioned me to do 3 volumes in 2006, 10 years each. And I think that's probably fine. I think there's got to be a certain amount of time to give you a perspective, which is very, very important. If it's too close to the present day, it's all a bit like a gossip column, or it's a bit like the newspapers.
Yeah.
If it's sort of 20 years ago, 25 years ago, then it's kind of it's almost historical significance. There's something there, a bit of social history, which gives it an extra bit of spice. And that's really what I wanted in publishing the diaries, was not to sort of... I mean, I was able to be selective and cut things out, but it was more like a record of the period I'd lived through. So I was trying to get a balance of what was happening in the world and what we were all sort of worried about at the time, what we were anxious about. And that, I think, is much more intense and means much more if you leave a gap, I think, of at least 20 years. So where that, 1998? Well, yeah. So I think
you've bought yourself a few years with that answer.
Yes, yes, not much. Yeah. I think probably, I'm very happy just to have those out now and then my family can do the rest later on.
Yeah. And do you think that they would report it differently?
What, you mean they would edit it differently?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't really know. I don't think any of them would particularly want to undertake the task, to be honest. Plus, my middle son's quite cute. I mean, I realise they've all got their lives, you know. They're busy. The idea that dad should take over. It's not something that's ever been part of our family life. They've always gone on and done their own things, and dad's been a bit of a, you know, he does something in comedy and all that sort of stuff. Until, as I say, last year at O2, when suddenly a certain amount of
you've
respect...
You've done something to impress
him. Yes, something, yeah.
At last,
yes. I've done something useful.
Yeah. Well, look, this is a great time. We've got another 25 minutes or so, and I know there's a lot of people here. And Michael's very kindly agreed to answer anybody's questions. So if you would like to stick your hand in the air and wait for a mic. But first of all, the gentleman here, and then one there. Can you wait for the mic, so otherwise no one else will hear you?
Right, thank you. Michael, if you'll excuse me, I'll address myself first to John, because Monday is Digested Read Day.
Yes.
And
very good.
I would Like if you can finish the evening, John, with Michael Palin's Digested Listen, Digested.
I was hoping I was going to mention, because I did actually digest the diary, the third volume of Diaries, and I was hoping Michael or someone in the audience wasn't going to bring this up.
I wasn't sure if you'd done it or
I
Craig
did,
Brown
no,
had done
no,
it.
No,
Craig
no.
Brown also had a go, yes. I know. Yeah. That's, yeah, yeah.
No, because
very funny.
Today,
his KP bit.
To Michael, I'd say the first travelogue of yours I remember was The Great Railway Journey of the World, where went on the Flying Scotsman and...
Yes.
Linked with my childhood by talking with your Ian Allen ABC down at Sheffield Midland Station, as I did at the same sort of time. So Ian Allen passed away earlier this year. Yeah. Do you think he's got a lot to answer for?
well, Ian Allen was... don't want to get into train spotting too much, but yes, it was my Bible for a certain time. And I was very keen on getting names of trains down and underlining it and all that, which I think was a sort of early form of wanting to keep a diary, sort of a record of what I did and all that. But the great thing about The Great Railway Journey was that the series started in 1980, and I was only asked... Well, I'd been on a radio show and I'd been talking about trains and how I thought they were a very good thing and we should build more railways and invest more in the railways and all that. I was rung up the next morning by this... director said, I'm doing this series, Great Railway Journeys of the World. Great to hear you're interested in trains. Would you like to be on board? And I said, well, where are the journeys? Oh, we've got one Trans-Siberian, we've got one going down through Australia, right through the heart of Australia, Alice Springs. We've got one going across the Limpopo Valley, one from Bolivia. There's one going to Seattle, to Vancouver through the Rocky. I said, absolutely, you're on. And he said... Then he said, well, they've all gone. and that's how I ended up with London to Crewe, which is the only one. But gave me a chance to go on the Flying Scotsman.
Yeah. So, gentleman over here.
Thank you. Where do you do your writing and why? Do you write in the kitchen, in the bedroom, in your office? And why do you choose... the venue. Oh,
that's very interesting. I quite like being asked about things. I love to know how writers write and what they write with. I write in... I do have an office, a sort of study, and that's where I write, really. When I was writing a novel, I found I couldn't write at home. There were just too many distractions. And I had to have my mind completely clear. So... I would have written, you know, I write my diaries, but also the travel books I would have written at home because I needed lots of books around me. But when it came to the novel, I just couldn't do it. And I had to go and I rented a room in Camden Town in the house where, coincidentally, where Dylan Thomas used to live. And I got the top flat there, and that's where I wrote the novels. But I like to be in one place and write. Some people I know can just put a board on their, you know, knee and just scribble anywhere. I have to be somewhere where I can sit and concentrate. So usually I have a very nice workroom now, which looks out over gardens and it's green and it's very pleasant. That's where I am. And occasionally I go downstairs and bother the rest of the family. Usually I keep myself to myself. I'm quite a hermit when I'm writing.
So, gentleman in the middle there.
Thank you. You've spoken a couple of times about anxiety and fear and about whether... I wondered whether that had actually... There were times when you'd been so anxious or worried about what you were doing and whether it was going to work out that you actually held off and didn't go through and didn't do it in the end and whether you regretted that.
That's a very good question. I'd like to say no because I think, you know, it's part of the job. And I've done some big things like Around the World in 80 Days, and I can remember, just because the diary goes on about it, doing GBH, which is a very big series Alan Bleasdale wrote. One of the two leads in that. And I hadn't done any acting for a while. I thought, my God, you know, how can I do this? And the anxiety and all that, it's kind of part of it, and you get through it. I don't think I can think of anything where I said, no, I'm not up to this. There are things that I knew I wasn't good at. I mean, the great thing, because John Lloyd goes on about it, was I was asked to do QI before Stephen Fry was asked. And John Lloyd thought I'd be perfect as the chairman of QI. And I knew I wouldn't. I just wasn't really interested enough in that sort of format. And I knew if I did do it, I wouldn't do it very well. So that wasn't really anxiety. That was just sort of reality coming in. But I don't think there's anything... Yes, it's a good question. I'll have to think about that. But I don't think there's anything I've absolutely said no to. I've just usually gone through with it because, you know, there's nothing to fear but fear itself and all that. So off you go.
Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
I'd just like to ask, are you as bad as you are good?
I can be, yes. Yeah. I can be very bad, but I get deep anxiety before I'm being bad, so I think I'm not really a bad bloke, but I would like to be every now and then. Yeah. I do enjoy it when I get offered parts of, you know, where you're playing somebody truly bad. Terry Gilliam, bless him, gave me a part in Brazil, in which I was a torturer. And not only did I love doing the part, I also, the great supreme sort of moment was that I got shot dead by Robert De Niro, which for me, as a huge fan of Robert De Niro's work, was just the greatest thing ever.
What, like to be being, shot by Robert De Niro?
Be shot by, yeah, Robert De Niro, yeah. It's like being kissed by, you know, Meg Ryan. I was trying to think of somebody younger, but that's not fair. Yeah. Cameron Diaz. Mm. So, very good question, that, by the way.
With passages like the ones you read, how long after the fact, with passages like that, how long after the fact do you actually write them? Or do you take any, like, extemporary notes at the time?
Or with the diaries?
Yeah, with the diaries.
Yeah, I write the next morning. I don't write the same day, because that's just impossible. And in the evening, your handwriting gets rather sort of blurry, if you've had a drink or two, but also you're tired, and I think it's just quite good to have 12 hours to sort of assess and look back. Any more than that, you're beginning to be so selective because you can't remember things. I mean, you can never remember everything, even, you know, a few hours later, but I think by writing the next morning, you've got your best chance to try and remember what you want to record about the day before.
And how long do you give yourself to write?
Ah, good, yeah, good question. Well, I mean, half an hour maximum.
Right.
And I like to get done in 20 minutes, but some days just go on and on and on. If you're not very careful, you're trying to explain more and more about it, and you're remembering more of what happened. And I remember Alan Bennett, who's very much gave me some very good advice, because I went to him when someone suggested publishing the diaries. I said, you publish your diaries every year, Alan, what do you think? And he said, oh, well, you know, I think it's quite a good idea if you've got something to say. he said, the problem is I had to stop my diary because I was just living my life for the diary, not the other way around. I know what you mean. There's a certain point where you're kind of thinking, and I do have a phrase which I use to people, I say, good for the diary. Yeah. Which means something truly awful has happened or whatever. But
yeah.
But Alan was quite rightly saying, if you're not very careful, you just spend the whole day writing up your diary.
Yeah.
You don't live the life. In fact, now it's getting quite difficult because I have to write. I'll write, you know, talk to John, very, very nice man, Guardian, John Trace.
I'll check that in 20 years' time.
About writing my diary. He asked me when I wrote the diary. Well, here I am writing the diary at the time I'm writing the diary. So it all gets very, very incestuous. Half an hour, 20 minutes should be enough. It's good discipline. It's very good each morning. I don't know. Well, you're a very good writer. You write your stuff. I mean, you're always in the paper and all that. But I find that it's just good to keep my descriptive sort of hand in, as it were, to try and write a record of the day before in 20 minutes or so, in reasonable style.
No, so? Well, my day generally starts with anxiety and panic.
Really?
Sort of,
yeah.
I could learn from you, I feel.
All right, really? Oh. It doesn't show in your work. Anyway, sorry.
And there are a miss, because some of it you lost, didn't you?
I did. I lost a few months, yes. I think quite early on. Mm. I think my second son, Will, was then a little baby. I think he dumped it in the bin. And, maybe very presciently.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't have to read about his early childhood. And also, I lost some diary when we were filming in Africa. And a bag got stolen or got lost on Zambian Airways, and so there's a whole chunk there. And also, when we were filming New Europe, the only time I ever had any baggage stolen was at Budapest Airport in Hungary, and all my notes for the Baltic Republics were all just gone. And that was awful, really. I felt sort of like losing something on the computer, that terrible feeling of gut. Your sort of stomach just falls to the floor. You think, oh, God. But I sat down, and we had a day before we were going to start filming in Budapest. I just sat in the hotel room and tried to recall it. An awful lot actually did come back, but that wasn't. It's not nice.
No.
You just keep a written diary. It could easily get lost. I don't travel with my main diary. I keep at home. I don't like to take it with me, so I have smaller diaries when I travel.
Well, so there are sort of mini diaries.
Yeah, they're little more like
sub diaries.
More like notebooks. Yeah, right. sub diaries. I mean, I will just write down things I see. Mm. I like, they'll get little moments when you see things which you know the camera will have missed. Like, I like signs particularly, and there's a wonderful sign in the Philippines, a long, low, modern building. It just said, Immaculate Conception Funeral Parlour. I've got to write that down. You know, no one will believe this. All human life is there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of an oxymoron, you know.
Yes, yes. Exactly.
It's perfect.
Yes.
Oxymoronical. Sorry. We've got loads. First of all, the woman in the middle at the back, then there's a gentleman in somewhere further forward.
Which is your favourite Python sketch and the favourite country that you visited on your travels?
Oh, you want everything. I always say my favourite Python sketch is the fish slapping dance. Because really it's so short and completely inconsequential, and yet it is very, very funny. I don't know quite why. I've seen it played many, many times, and it was just dreamt up almost at the last minute. And it's just me, as you know, sort of slapping John with two little fish repeatedly to the music, and then there's a pause, and he hits me with a very big fish, and I fall into the water. And I don't know quite why it's so funny. There are certain little things in it, one of which is very military. We do it with military precision. We're doing a very silly thing with military precision. And there's a great moment when John, before John hits me with the big fish, he just gets the fish out and he sort of presents it, like presenting arms, and sort of just weighs it up and then hits me, you know, whereas lesser comedians have just got it out and hit me. It's a little weighing up. So you know what's going to happen. You know it's going to hit me. Just getting lined up and then it happens. And also a very good fall, I have to say, which I will tell you briefly about, because we shot at Teddington Lock and I was just going to fall into the water of the lock. And we were rehearsing the lock, you know, the little dance and all that, and the lock was full. And when it came to the take, the lock had emptied. So And I didn't dare say, I'm not going to do this, loves, until the water fills up. I just went with it and fell about 15 feet. And it's a really, really good fall. I mean, it's the thing I'm most proud of in all my professional life. Some people have split the atom and all that, but I did the fish tapping dance.
I think I'd have been more of a diva myself. I'd have waited for it to fill up.
Yes, but you're a sensible man. You're a very sensible man. But if there were a Nobel Prize for comedy, I think that's what it'd be.
Yeah.
Anyway. What was your other one? The favourite country? Oh, it's really hard. I mean, I know I say this corny thing. It's home, really. That's your favourite country. It's the one you know, the one where you've got your roots, the one, you know, the many things you think are wrong with it. But my God, it's great to come back to a place where you just know the subtext, the context, the places, you know. But I've been to, I mean, many of the countries I've been to are just fantastic. Peru, anywhere really, South Africa, Zambia, Kenya. I just go on really, I can't remember them all. Egypt. Cyprus was a bit boring. Oh, God. We used to do our travels, and the The nightmare was that we get somebody who would be in our coach who would give us a guided tour, you know, because the crew would absolutely shattered. As soon as you got on the coach, everyone sat in the back. So you get someone saying, welcome to our country. On the right, you'll be seeing, just immediately everyone disappeared to the back of the bus and all that. I remember that happened in Cyprus quite badly, so that's probably why I remember it. Beautiful country.
Lovely, shame about the
lovely
bus.
Currency. Yeah.
The gentleman in the middle.
Michael, I watched GBH after I read about it in your diary.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, it was such a brilliant series. Why haven't you graced us with more series more series, really?
Well, things like GBH don't come along very often. And I've been very lucky. I had a run of things, including, the Python films, but also A Fish Called Wanda. And yes, you do things like that and you look around, just nothing with the same sort of quality. And I felt that with GBH. It was on the last, if not... No, I think it was the last big political drama that Alan Bleasdale did. And then, so there wasn't really much around, and I was by that time tempted to go on another travel, do another journey. And somehow the travel was always the thing that I was most easily... seduced into, rather than the acting. I don't quite know why. I think because it obviously hit a kind of format which was very, very popular and very successful and enabled you to see a lot of the world, and also people enjoyed what you were doing and the way you were presenting it and all that. It was hard to sort of stop that momentum. As I say, you know, there's sort of, you've got to get the right part at the right time, and there was not a great deal of stuff offered to me that I felt other people couldn't do much better.
I'm sure that's not true.
It took you a while.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Now, if we're going to go to... business as a double act,
I'm
get quicker than that.
Sorry, I've got to get my timing better. I'm sorry.
We hadn't rehearsed, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, hello.
You were always carrying your trusty Bellingham bag. What was in it?
Toilet paper and tea bags. that's about it. And diary and camera. But diary, very most important thing of all.
Is there any? Oh, sorry. There's a woman right at the top. We it's hard to spot people in the balcony.
Oh yeah.
Hello, Michael.
yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh dear, I think you ought to have that treated.
I should have gone to Specsavers too.
It was a dress that threw you, wasn't it? Yeah. Yes, Grayson.
Michael, 35 years ago, I named our family dog after you, in honour of you. He turned out to be one of the funniest dogs I've ever known. But I'd like to ask, do you know of anything else, living or non-living, that's been named after you?
The two railway engines were named after me, actually. I did have two trains named after me. It's not the first time I've had a... What was your dog called? Was it called Michael Palin or just Palin? Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a rather lot to call out tonight. Michael Palin, Michael Palin. Yeah. If I'd been walking past your house, I'd have been really thrown.
The dog was taken to a lot of dog shows, and my mother would call across the field shouting, "Michael," and countless sort of men would look around and start what was calling for him.
It was like a... Someone I know called their dog Burglar. So go out at night and chat, "Burglar!" But I don't know if many other people who call their dogs Palin or Michael Palin. There's one person did. And that's very touching, really.
What, to have a pet named after you?
Yes, yeah. I think so, don't you? Wouldn't you like to have a pet called John, Chris?
Well, I'm not sure that people don't tend to call their dogs John.
Really?
They call something else.
I did actually want to call my dog Ian, on the grounds that I didn't know of any other dogs called Ian. But I was overruled by the rest of the family.
I should think so. What did we
ended up with Herbert.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. Yeah, that's much better. Yeah,
yeah.
Ian is a very strange name for a dog. It's just not quite right. You imagine a dog with a kind of shirt on.
Yeah.
Called Ian.
It's sort of like Colin, really. Colin doesn't work. That was my second choice.
Yeah.
But didn't pass muster.
We used to like the name, Eric a lot. Well, we had Eric Idle.
Yeah.
You know, the man who wanted to get a license for his pet fish.
Yeah.
I want to get a license for my pet fish, Eric. How do you know my name was Eric? No, my pet fish is called Eric. So it's very important. There's a lot in the name, isn't there?
Yeah.
And we could go on. Why are fish funny in comedy and other things aren't? A haddock is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. But halibut's very hilarious, isn't it? Hilarious. And donkey, not so much, really.
No.
Puma, not at all funny.
Yeah. We have another question. Man at the back. It is a man. Yes, good.
In all of the opportunities that have presented themselves to you, I just wondered if many opportunities to perform in plays on stage had, and if that interested you.
It does interest me, and I feel it was actually the early question of talking about anxiety and fear, and I knew that there was something, and I do get asked to do plays and West End plays, and some of them have been the most tempting roles. And I think I just find that adjustment to that way of life where you wait all day long and just work in the evening and, would be very, very different from the way I normally like to work. But it's also the fact of doing a run of at least 6 months. That's what you have to sign up for. And doing the same thing night after night. And I don't know whether my attention span will work. I'm very lucky because I'm always doing lots of different things and got little projects here and there. And actually the concentration of doing a play is something that has actually slightly put me off. And I feel I've missed a few opportunities there and I should have gone for it. So that answers that first question, the earlier question about fear and anxiety. I'm absolute slight fear of committing myself to a stage play. But I'd love to do it. And in fact, I've been doing a tour around the country for these diaries. And it's the second one I've done since the O2. And I love playing in front of a live audience. It's just been terrific. And I think I would like to do plays more than I would like to do more television. But it's just actually making the decision to take that leap and say, come on, you've got to learn those words and you've got to remember them every single night.
Yeah, you'll have to miss your sort of Nordic noir on the telly as well.
Yes, well, I could watch that during the morning.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, that's very mundane.
Yeah.
No, it's different. It is a very, very different way of life.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'd do with the rest of my day. I probably would not be able to do very much because I'd be worrying about whether I could do this thing right in the evening.
Yeah.
But I have, I wouldn't mind doing Samuel Beckett. And we've always, Robert Lindsay and myself, always discussed doing Waiting for Godot together or something like that, which he'd be great to work with.
Well, that would be
and that's
a treat.
Not so many words, and some of them are coming. Yeah, that would be a treat, wouldn't it?
It would be a treat.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll ring him up again.
Can we keep you to that?
come back in a year's time and we'll see. Yeah.
We've just got time for a couple more questions, but ooh, we've now got three hands in the we've got the woman at the front here.
Four.
Should
five,
we just keep it
six?
I've got can we just go let's start with the woman.
It's
here.
Like GM crops here. So many hands going up.
Michael, if you're enjoying doing live stage shows, could we possibly expect a musical of Ripping Yarns, perhaps?
Ooh.
If Eric Idle's done Spamalot?
I'd have to get Eric Idle to write it, because he's a music man. That's interesting. Yeah. The idea of doing musicals now is a very big thing, and everyone's doing musicals of this, that, and the other. And I know there's some musicals of The Life of Brian being mooted and all that sort of thing. John Cleese has been endlessly trying to write The Fish Called Wanda musical.
Has he?
But hasn't got done yet. But I think onward and upward, I probably wouldn't do that. That wouldn't be the course I'd take with my material, I think. I'm not musical enough, but I do love watching people on stage musicalizing.
Well, of course, the good Andrew Lloyd Webber was back in town for the tax credit vote last week.
Oh.
So if you're in need of a composer, there you go.
We have a woman in the middle there.
Hello, thank you for getting my gender right. I appreciate that.
Well, it's 50-50.
I was about to make a heartfelt speech about getting over my fear of public speaking, but I won't bother. I was just wondering, what are you up to next, Michael?
Well, I've got various small things to do in the near future. I'm actually doing quite a serious thing, which is the Longford Lecture, which is a lecture that I think the Telegraph sponsor it, and it's been, in the name of Lord Longford, who was a great prison reformer and all that, and I've been quite interested in prison reform charities and all that. So I'm giving the Longford Lecture this year on November the 17th about the effect of a prison sentence on families and all that, called collateral damage, because families get ignored totally and they're given a very hard time. And, it's I think it's something that's quite scandalous, especially if you're trying to rely on the family to rehabilitate whoever's in prison at the end of their sentence. You've got to do your very best to help the family. Anyway, so I'll be doing that. That's what I'm doing. And then, I can't remember what else I'm doing. What am I doing, Tom?
Well, in the immediate future, you'll be signing copies of your diary.
That's immediate future, yes.
I'm sorry for everyone who hasn't had time to keep it, to get in the question. But Michael will be signing copies of his diaries very, very shortly. Mm. And I'm sure you'd like with me to thank Michael for coming along and being so entertaining and just making life so much more pleasurable and lovelier for all of us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.